Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
You see now, they've turned the clocks ahead, but the clocks are 2 seconds slow. I got it. It's all good. Yes, the ladies and gentlemen, the clocks here in London and in all over the United Kingdom, for that matter, still in Scotland, too, have just been turned ahead. They did not join the headlong rush that the United States was in a few years back to save more daylight. But look who's laughing now, because we're exporting some of that excess saved daylight to Ukraine right now. And that's going to make all the difference. Speaking of places where we've made a difference, ladies and gentlemen, the new Iraq. A sharp rise in capital punishment was recorded in the past year. More than two-thirds of the world's executions were accounted for by Iran. Yeah. And Iraq! Although significantly fewer countries use the death penalty today than two decades ago, killing sprees, in the words of the Amnesty International, in Iran and Iraq helped cause a 15% increase in the number of executions globally. This is according to Amnesty International's annual survey on death sentences. At least 778 executions were known to have been carried out globally last year, 538 of them in Iran and Iraq alone, up from 682 executions the year before. China is believed to have executed several thousand people, more than the rest of the world together, but exact figures are unavailable. Beijing authorities classify execution statistics as a state secret. They have a state secrets policy, much like another country I know. Iran officially acknowledged the execution of at least 369 people, up 55 from the year before. Activists say many hundreds more were put to death in secret. Iraq executed at least 169 people, an increase of almost a third from the previous year. Amnesty said many were executed on vague charges related to anti-terrorism laws, so we've taught them well. Saudi Arabia acknowledged executing at least 79 people, of whom three were juvenile offenders, in defiance of international law. The U.S. put to death 39. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, in executions, we are not number one. But more about the new Iraq. The entire board, you know, we left a democracy there, didn't we? The entire board of Iraq's Electoral Commission tendered its resignation this week in protest against political interference, which casts doubt on a nationwide vote scheduled for next month. The independent High Electoral Commission said it had found itself caught between conflicting rulings from Parliament and the judiciary regarding the exclusion of certain candidates from the election. The commission's sudden move further complicates the outlook for a vote already clouded by violence across the country, where Sunni Islamist militants have regained momentum over the past year. Whatever happened to that surge? Remember that surge? Back when we could all talk like this? The commission is subject to intense pressures resulting from the conflict between the legislative and judiciary powers, it said in a statement. In order to get out of this vicious circle, the members of the Electoral Commission have taken the decision to present their resignation collectively. The statement said the conflict stemmed from divergent interpretations of election law, which includes a clause allowing for candidates of ill repute to be barred from taking part. Critics of the Prime Minister Maliki have accused him of using the law to eliminate his political rivals. He's our guy. He wouldn't have done that. Ill repute. And the new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, one more time. As recently as the 1970s, Baghdad was lauded as a model city in the Arab world. This is from the Daily Star of Beirut. Now, after decades of seemingly endless conflict, it is the world's worst city. That, at least, is according to the latest survey by the Mercer Consulting Group, which assesses quality of life across 239 cities, measuring factors including political stability, crime, and pollution. It placed Baghdad last. The Iraqi capital was lumped with Bangul in the conflict-hit Central African Republic and the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. The latest confirmation of the 1,250-year-old city's fall from grace as a global intellectual, economic, and political center. Residents of Baghdad contend with near-daily attacks, a lack of electricity and clean water, poor sewerage and drainage systems, rampant corruption, regular gridlock, high unemployment, and some other problems. You folks are so welcome. and it only cost us $1 trillion to give that stuff to you. We live in military barracks, said a paper salesman, referring to the now ubiquitous checkpoints, concrete blast walls, and security forces peppered throughout the city. The city was constructed, the construction began in 762 A.D. during the rule of Abbasid Caliph Abu Jafar al-Mansur. You're welcome. In the 20th century, Baghdad was held up as a gleaming example of a modern Arab city with some of the region's best universities and museums. We took care of that. A highly educated elite, a vibrant cultural scene, and top-notch health care. In February alone, 57 violent incidents struck the Iraqi capital, including 31 car bombs. I'm actually hurt that Baghdad ranked among the worst cities in the world, says Amir al-Chalabi, there's a familiar name, last name, head of the Humanitarian Construction Organization, an NGO which runs civic campaigns aimed at improving the city's services. It has become deserted and it suffers from instability. At night, it turns into a ghost town because of the lack of lighting. Masses of electrical wires run along neighborhood streets as privately operated communal generators work to make up for the shortfall in electricity from the national grid. Poor drainage means that even moderate levels of rainfall during the winter lead to flooding as pools form on the city's potholed streets. Baghdad's problems cannot be counted, says the paper seller. Sometimes it makes us cry, he says. Beautiful Baghdad is today in ruins. You folks are so welcome. Really, seriously. It was our pleasure. Really? No. Seriously, don't bother to thank us. From the new home of Daylight Saving Time, London, England, hello, welcome to the show.
There ought to be a moonlight saving time so I could love that man of mine till the birdies wake and chime good morning. There ought to be a law in clover time to keep that moon out over time, to keep each lover's lane in rhyme till dawning. You'd better hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, get busy today. You'd better croon a tune to the man in the moon, and here's what I'd say. There ought to be a moonlight saving time so I could love that man of mine till the birdies wake and chime good morning.
From just this side of Leicester Square in London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide, to beautify our countryside. We offer you our let us try.
Oh, that's a dangerous hand to offer. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has decided, ladies and gentlemen, it will no longer force local levee agencies to choose between keeping trees on their levees and getting federal money for disaster assistance.
Save our precious land. Let us try.
This week, the Army Corps announced in a new interim policy that it will not disqualify levees that failed to meet its maintenance criteria from receiving disaster relief funding, essentially granting a reprieve to thousands of miles of California riverside habitat. The move appears to resolve, for now, a long-running policy dispute that pitted the state of California against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This is from the Sacramento Bee, by the way. This is really quite a substantial change, says Tammy Conforti, levee safety program manager at the Army Corps. That specific vegetation criteria won't be one of the criteria that has to be met, she says, confusing the singular of criterion with the plural. Until now, the agency has said that trees threaten levee safety and must be removed. This is one of their reactions to the disaster that befell New Orleans in 2005, where trees on levees were not a factor. But, you know, you got to react. It argued that tree roots could serve as a path for seepage through a levee, or that trees could topple over in a storm and tear out chunks of a levee. Its vegetation standards allow nothing but short grass, not even small shrubs or trees. Levees with too many trees risked being disqualified from a federal program that provides millions of dollars in levee repair grants in the event of a flood. Such a disqualification also put communities at risk of displeasing FEMA, which sets flood insurance rates. There's been little scientific proof that trees actually threaten levee stability, though. Officials at the California State Department of Water Resources and the Department of Fish and Wildlife both opposed the policy, warning it could bankrupt local levee districts and destroy the last of the state's riverside habitat. Since, aside from the trees on the levees, probably aren't a lot of other places for critters to hang out. In its new interim policy, not a real policy, just an interim policy, the Army Corps is now saying it will still inspect levees according to the same vegetation standards, but it will no longer use that particular rating to decide whether a local sponsor agency is eligible for financial assistance. The vegetation rating will be for informational purposes only. By the way, local sponsor means you share the bill with the Army Corps. That's how they do that thing. Quote, we want to make sure we're not incentivizing local sponsors to do something with the vegetation without taking into account endangered species, said Tammy Conforti. We heard the public feedback and take that very seriously, that we need to better take into account local objections, local constraints. George Qualley, a flood management policy advisor at the California Department of Water Resources, praised the Army Corps move, said it would allow levee districts to spend their limited funds on more pressing issues, such as erosion and encroachment by buildings and utilities. Really, they move? He said the emphasis on vegetation was a potentially costly distraction. Quote, I could never figure out why they were making such a focus on it. My initial impression is it's a step in the right direction, and they're cognizant of what's really important as far as keeping the levees safe. I would just say good for them. They've finally put something out there with logic in it, unquote. Well, it's interim logic. Let them just try. Just let them try. That's all I have to say. Let us try, ladies and gentlemen, the motto of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Now, news of the godly. And it just keeps getting better. Italy's bishops have adopted a policy with backing from the Vatican that says they're not obliged to inform police officers if they suspect a child has been molested. And yes, the dateline on this story is this year. The Italian Bishops' Conference says the guidelines, published just this Friday, when they used to talk like this, reflected suggestions from the Vatican's office that handles sex abuse investigations. So they've studied the matter. Victims have denounced how bishops systematically covered up abuse by moving priests while keeping prosecutors in the dark. That's not the only people they kept in the dark. Only in 2010 did the Vatican instruct bishops to report abuse to police, but only where required by law. Italian guidelines cite a 1985 treaty between the Vatican and Italy, stipulating that clergy aren't obliged to tell magistrates about information obtained through their religious ministry. The guidelines remind bishops, however, they have a moral duty to contribute to the common good. A UN report published this very month blasted what it called the Vatican's code of silence around abusive priests. UN children's rights experts estimate tens of thousands of children worldwide have been sexually abused by predatory clerics as a result of moving rather than reporting pedophiles. Or as they call them in England, pedophiles. They call they, you know, shorthand slang, pedos. You got to be careful because it sounds so much like something else, but it's pedos with only one S. And you may have been wondering, where's John McCain been? Well, he's deep into this Ukraine thing. He was over there last week, I believe. This is from New Statesman, a report by Angus Roxburgh, who used to be BBC's Moscow correspondent. He said Senator McCain swept into town. This is a town in Ukraine, but it doesn't say which, and shared a stage with Oleh Tyanibok, leader of the far-right anti-Semitic Svoboda Party, a man, says Roxburgh, who in many Western countries would be a pariah, a politician from the same stable as Jörgi Haider, whose election victory in Austria several years ago caused the European Union to impose sanctions against his government. Did McCain know this? Was he, as he was after he met with Gaddafi in Libya, just impressed with him as a very interesting man?
I think Harry might have gone over the line here.
All right. Okay. That's up to you to say, Senator. That's for you to say and for me to decide. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Well, I don't think this would necessarily qualify as a good news week for News of the Warm, unless you like your salamanders small. Maybe they're tastier small. Wild salamanders living in some of North America's best salamander habitat are getting smaller as their surroundings get warmer and drier, forcing them to burn more energy in a changing climate. If we could hook them up to wind turbines, that's the key finding of a new study published in the journal Global Change Biology that examined museum specimens caught in the Appalachian Mountains from 1957 to 2007 and wild salamanders measured at the same sites in 2011-12. The salamanders studied from 1980 onward were on average 8% smaller than their counterparts from earlier decades. So if don't feel you're being cheated by your salamander dealer. This is he can't help it. The changes were most marked in the southern Appalachians and at low elevation settings where detailed weather records showed the climate has warmed and dried out most. Scientists have predicted some animals will get smaller in response to climate change. This is the strongest confirmation to date of that prediction, reports Science Daily. This is one of the largest and fastest rates of change ever recorded in any animal, says Karen R. Lips, an associate professor of biology at the University of Maryland and the study's senior author. She adds, we don't know exactly how or why it's happening, but our data show it is clearly correlated with climate change, unquote. It is happening at a time when salamanders and other amphibians are in distress, with some species going extinct, others dwindling in number. But the salamanders just choose to shrink themselves. And six massive glaciers in West Antarctica are moving faster than they did 40 years ago, causing more ice to discharge into the ocean and global sea level to rise, according to new research. So stuff isn't shrinking, it's moving faster. The amount of ice draining collectively from those half-dozen glaciers increased by 77% over the last 40 years, scientists report this month in Geophysical Research Letters, a journal of the American Geophysical Union. Pine Island Glacier, the most active of the studied glaciers, has accelerated by 75% in 40 years, putting a whole new spin on the phrase glacial speed, glacial pace. Thwaites Glacier, The widest one started to accelerate in 2006 following a decade of stability. The study is the first to look at the ice coming off the six most active West Antarctic glaciers over such an extended time period, says a glaciologist at UC Irvine, who co-authored the paper. About 10% of the world's sea level rise each year comes from just those six glaciers. What we found was a sustained increase in ice discharge, which has a significant impact on sea level rise, he said. News in the warm, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, what the frack? The former owner of a Youngstown, Ohio-based wastewater company has pleaded guilty to federal Clean Water Act violations in the dumping of thousands of gallons of fracking wastewater into an Ohio storm sewer. Ben Lupo changed his earlier not guilty plea during a hearing before a judge in Cleveland. He faces up to 3 years in prison and a maximum fine of $250,000. Authorities had charged that Lupo of Poland, Ohio, well, there you go, ordered an employee at Hard Rock Excavating to repeatedly dump drilling mud and brine, intended for deep injection, into a sewer that empties into the Mahoning River. Or he dumped the material himself. The employee was sentenced to 3 years of probation and a bunch of community service. The U.S. attorney said he was pleased Lupo had admitted his actions. Randall Ash from the EPA said the case sends a signal to the state's growing energy industry. This case demonstrates that if companies and their owners skirt environmental laws, EPA will hold them accountable. Hard Rock's facility in Youngstown had about 58 mobile storage tanks holding a combined 20,000 gallons of waste, including oily mud and chemical-laced brine. Lupo directed an employee to empty some of the liquid waste into a nearby drain after everybody else had left the facility and after dark. So he's not dumb. Didn't do it in broad daylight. Can't accuse him of that. A sample of the discharge collected end of January last year, the last night of the dumping, and that's always a major event. People dress up for that. The sample discharge was black in color and contained several hazardous pollutants, including benzene and toluene. Ladies and gentlemen, you may be aware that companies that do fracking have persistently refused to give state or other environmental authorities a list of the chemicals they inject into these shale formations to release the natural gas, claiming that those concoctions, the recipe of those concoctions, are trade secrets. So one of the few ways we know what's in there, what's in that stuff, is when it comes back out and when somebody tries to dump it in a waterway. Toluene. That's good stuff, that toluene. More. What the frack, despite a population of barely 30,000, Uinta County in Utah is home to a combined 11,200 oil and gas-producing wells. Over time, their presence led to researchers' discovery that the area exceeded the U.S. EPA ambient air quality standards level for ozone pollutants for 39 days last winter, placing it above the typical summertime levels of Los Angeles. The results were reported in highly elevated atmospheric levels of volatile organic compounds in the Uinta Basin, Utah, a paper by a group of University of Colorado Boulder researchers. So if you think the air in rural Utah nice and clean, think again. And finally, on the subject of fracking, at the end of 2011, Chesapeake Energy, one of the nation's biggest oil and gas companies, was teetering on the brink of failure. Its legendary chief executive officer, Aubrey McClendon, was being pilloried for questionable deals. Its stock price was getting hammered, and the company needed to raise billions of dollars. In the months that followed, Chesapeake raised nearly $5 billion with a previously undisclosed twist. This is from a report by ProPublica. By gouging many rural landowners out of royalty payments they were supposed to receive in exchange for allowing the company to drill fracking for natural gas on their property. In lawsuits in state after state, private landowners have won cases accusing companies like Chesapeake of stiffing them on royalties that were due. Federal investigators have repeatedly identified underpayments of royalties for drilling on federal lands, including a case in which Chesapeake was fined $765,000 for knowing or willful submission of inaccurate information just last year. The losers, landowners in Pennsylvania and elsewhere who leased their land to Chesapeake and saw their hopes of cashing in on the fracking boom, go bust without explanation. Chesapeake's conduct is part of a larger national pattern in which many giant energy companies have maneuvered to pay as little as possible to the owners of the land they drill on. Last year, a ProPublica investigation found Pennsylvania landowners were paying ever higher fees to companies for transporting gas to market and that Chesapeake was charging more than other companies. The question was why? Well, the story ends up like this. When energy companies lease the land above the shale rock that contains natural gas, they typically agree to pay the owner the market price for any gas they find. Federal rules limit the expenses that can be charged against that, but drilling companies like Chesapeake can levy any fees they want for moving gas through local pipelines, gathering lines they're called, that link backwoods wells to the nation's interstate pipelines. Property owners have no alternative to pay up. There's no other practical way to get their gas to market. Chesapeake took full advantage of this in a series of deals. It sold off its network of local pipelines, lines it had built in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Louisiana, Texas, and other fracking centers. Sold that to a newly formed company that it had evolved out of Chesapeake itself. So there it raised the $5 billion in cash. And in exchange, Chesapeake promised the new company, Access Midstream, that it would send much of the gas it discovered for at least the next decade through those pipes. And it pledged to pay Access enough in fees to repay the $5 billion plus a 15% guaranteed return. That much profit was possible only if Access charged Chesapeake significantly more for its pipeline services, and that's exactly what appeared to happen. And that got deducted from what Chesapeake owed to the landowners. ProPublica repeatedly sought comment and explanations from both Chesapeake and Access. That didn't happen. Days after the last of the deals closed, landowners learned the expense of sending their gas through Access's pipelines would eat up nearly all of the money they had previously been earning from their wells. Some saw their monthly checks fall by as much as 94%. What the frack? They should be grateful, ladies and gentlemen, because here in Great Britain, there are now attempts to legalize slant fracking, where companies who are denied permission by landowners to drill on their land can drill sideways from adjacent land to get to the shale and the gas. And that's for free. This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you've been listening to the broadcast any length of time, that I kind of go back and forth between this city from which I'm broadcasting now and most often New Orleans and sometimes Los Angeles. And, you know, I do that because partly because I've been doing some work here in London, which you're apparently never going to see. But anyway, that's another story. The question this raises, and I raise it with full awareness that this is the quintessence of a first world problem, but still, that doesn't keep it from being peculiar and interesting, and therefore, I throw it open to the wisdom of the vast audio radiance, because somebody out there probably knows the answer to this. When you fly, and I hope you do, from, let's say, New Orleans to Atlanta, New Orleans to London, you can't go nonstop. So you have to go through either Houston or Atlanta or a couple other cities that are even more out of the way. And I often end up going through Atlanta. Now, if you go from New Orleans to Atlanta, you change planes, and Bob's your uncle. You've gone through security in New Orleans. You just go to the and it's a little bit of a deal in Atlanta because you have to get on a tram. That's a good idea. That's good airport design. And then you get on the next plane. But when you come back, when you fly from London to the United States and land in Atlanta, before you can change planes, before you can get on your next flight, you have to go through security again. Now, you've not left what they call the sterile zone. You've been through security in London, goodness knows, to get on the plane. Your bags have been checked. If you have bags, they've gone through the thing, whatever the thing is. You've not gotten out of that zone. You've not gone, you've gotten off the plane, maybe gotten your bags, or if you didn't have luggage, you've just gone to the place where you want to connect to your next flight. But no, before you get there, there is a hugely crowded, because of this, security site, undermanned and underwomaned, to be fair. And what are they looking for? What can you possibly have touched or gotten? You've been on a plane. Your bag has been on a plane. It's all been through security to get to the plane. You've not been anywhere else, and now you have to go through security again. Somebody knows the answer to this. I had a TSA person. You know, you take your life in your hands when you ask a TSA person a question sometimes. But I did, and this was a couple of years ago. Oh, we're phasing that out. It's still going on. Am I being obtusely naive to think there's got to be a reason for it? You tell me, department. Hey, join the conversation. You know what? There is no conversation. I'm talking to you. But you can let me know if you have any words of wisdom on this subject. Now, news of AFPAC. Top U.S. diplomats connived, it now turns out, in delaying an Afghan presidential election in 2009, and then tried to manipulate the outcome in a clumsy and failed putsch. That's a quote that aimed to oust Hamid Karzai. That's a nugget that was buried deep in the book that former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates published earlier this year. Gates says the 2009 election was ugly, and that though the president was tainted, quote, our hands, meaning the United States, were dirty as well, unquote. The revelation was greeted with triumph in the presidential palace in Kabul, where Karzai and his confidants have long accused the U.S. of trying to push him out of office. Washington, on the other hand, has always insisted it was an impartial supporter of the democratic process. The row over the election has been one of many things poisoning ties between the two capitals ever since. As they say, once bitten, twice shy, says Karzai's spokesman. That's why, because of this bad experience of the past, we're trying to make sure we do not allow such interference from the outside. He doesn't have to worry. Other reports indicate most foreigners, including a lot of election observers, are leaving Afghanistan in the run-up to next week's elections as opposed to arriving there for them. The account of behind-scenes efforts to manipulate the election appears in Gates' book. The Afghan election was marred by widespread fraud in 2009 and badly damaged Karzai's international reputation. But Gates laments that the U.S., too, was stained by underhanded efforts to control the result. Quote, it was all ugly. Our partner, the president of Afghanistan, was tainted. Our hands were dirty as well. Our future dealings with Karzai always hugely problematic, and his criticisms of us are at least more understandable in the context of our clumsy and failed putsch. Unquote. Holbrook, the senior diplomat in Afghanistan, and AFPAC, the guy who invented, the phrase AFPAC, was doing his best to bring about the defeat of Karzai, Gates writes. What he really wanted was to have enough credible candidates running to deny Karzai a majority in the election, thus forcing a runoff in which he could be defeated, unquote. Tactics included advising candidates, attending rallies, and organizing high-profile photo opportunities, according to Gates. He says, Karzai could not have missed what Holbrook was doing. Quote, Karzai might not be a great president, but he sure as hell knew what was going on in his own capital and was well aware of the American efforts to unseat him, unquote. Karzai's spokesman said U.S. meddling in the poll went beyond the former defense secretary's account. Americans presented Karzai, he says, with a choice of accepting a chief executive to work beside him or facing the runoff he was likely to lose. Karzai chose the runoff, which he, in fact, eventually won. As you may know, on the other hand, former Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, was on Fox News this week blaming the Obama administration for the bad relationship between the United States and Karzai's government, saying a trained ape could have done better, and bragging about his administration's relationship with Karzai. The 2009 election, well, Holbrook was appointed by the Obama administration. Just doing the chronology for you. Anyway, as the U.S.-led war winds down and Russia reasserts itself in Ukraine and the Middle East, Moscow is also ramping up its investment in Afghanistan. The Washington Post reports it is rebuilding the relics of the Soviet occupation and promoting its own political and cultural prowess. You see Russia's interest in Afghanistan rising. It's visible, says the spokesman for the Russian embassy in Kabul. We want to enlarge our role in the region. It's not only for Afghanistan, but for our own goals. Well, there's a little bit of honesty for you. In Afghanistan, Russian officials point to their development activities as a counterexample to U.S. aid projects, which many Afghans criticize as wasteful and misguided. The mistake of the last 12 years, says the Russian ambassador, is that people were eager to give money but without the proper strategy. Many Afghans, including President Karzai, praised the Soviet model, even though they fought a bloody war against that country's army. The Soviet money went to the right place. They were efficient in spending their money and doing it through the Afghan government, said Karzai. Karzai, this week, you may have noticed, ladies and gentlemen, was one of the few international leaders to recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea. That's how it looks from here. How does it look from there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, offering driveway moments to people without driveways.
From the soon-to-be redecorated presidential palace in downtown Kabul, the city that never wakes up. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Stick and Stack, the Packet Brothers. Welcome to Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Afghanistan Election Commission, where clean elections are always possible.
So, my younger brother, you are soon coming to the end of the only presidency longer than Vladimir Putin's.
Yes, but unlike me, some of his oligarchic cronies aren't his blood relatives.
That's the only reason he needs an army that actually works.
Yes, as we approach the election of my successor, I have to say that one of my regrets is that
According to the American Inspector General, we have an army that largely cannot read.
But we have left the country with a bureaucracy that certainly can count.
So, six of one, out the other.
But you must be getting a little bit nostalgic as your term comes to an end, my brother.
Oh, certainly. I close my eyes sometimes and get a fond yearning for my first green robe.
Well, open your eyes. You're still wearing it.
And you, my older brother, do you regret the passing of the days when your Toyota dealership didn't have to hold a Toyota-thon to get a government contract?
No, my dear brother. Every major candidate to succeed you is driving around Kabul in an armored Prius. Mm. And it's not because they want to be seen as cool by the people at the Brentwood Mart.
speaking of Brentwood, my agent just called. He's already confirmed my first post-presidential appearance there.
Oh.
Yes, I'm hosting a dinner with three sleep researchers at Arianna Huffington's house.
Oop. You know a lot about sleep.
I know you don't do it in this building. Hello, you are on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is John, a long-time Secretary of State, second-time caller.
Mrs. Secretary, did you call to offer my brother windsurfing lessons? Because very soon he's going to have time to kill.
Oh, don't be so sure. Hmm? Maybe some of my would-be successors will be having windsurfing accidents.
Actually, Mahmoud, this may be my last chance to call in, and I just wanted to say that despite what Donald Rumsfeld said, I hope we've been pleasant and professional at all times, even when we disagree on something as basic as, well, with all due respect, Hamid recognizing the illegal annexation of Crimea, which I have to say feels to us like Hamid sticking his finger in our eye with all due respect.
I guess he feels like he owes us a whole lot of respect.
I think he means with all past due respect.
Mr. Secretary, have you ever ridden in a Zill limousine?
I may have, from time to time.
The new ones with satellite radio and the internet and free bootleg pay TV built in?
Well, I was on the phone at the time I was riding in one, so...
John, you know that I know from cars. When I say that the new Zill makes the Lincoln Town Car look like the out-of-town car...
I don't understand. Zill is... It's a Russian limousine.
Yes, that's right. And the shipment of 36 is coming into Kabul this weekend.
Well, Hamid, we are drawing down our troops, as you know, and certainly if the atmosphere diplomatically were to warm up just a little bit, I'm certain we could arrange a good deal on some Cadillacs, just driven a very few miles over New Kabul roads by some very cautious generals.
John, you sound like me hawking Tundras out the back door to our Taliban brothers. You know, when a Tundra gets blown up, it really gets blown up.
And, my friend, you know, the winds shift, the currents change, old friends leave, even older friends return.
Are we doing a talk show, or are you becoming a life coach?
Our Russian friends are picking up some of the burden you are wearily laying down.
Well, we're not that weary, and we wouldn't be laying it down if you'd sign that damn agreement.
Well, that's just it, John. The Russians aren't making us sign an agreement. Just a couple of press releases about Crimea, and the Russians are as happy as pigs in dust.
Don't you mean pigs in poop?
No, we're a poor country, John. We can only afford dust for the pigs. And by the way, John, if anything goes wrong with these ills...
Yeah.
The Russians are in the neighborhood. They've got a truck here within a month.
All right. Well, I love the show, and good luck with the elections.
Oh, luck has nothing to do with it. Thanks for the call.
I feel sorry for John. Hmm? So many dinners with us these last few years, and...
Your point?
It's just, no one wants to be the last man to dine for a mistake.
Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hello, it's Rummy. Two-time defense secretary, first-time caller.
Ooh, two secretaries on one show. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like the plan for my post-presidential office. Mr. Secretary, mm-hmm. If I'd known you were calling, we'd have trained an ape.
look, fellas, that's why I was calling. One reason also... my Afghanistan book tour starts next week.
Oh, your agent got you a book tour here?
Yes, sir. She tells me the Borders stores haven't closed there yet.
Well, that's half true.
Oh, well, what's the rest?
They haven't opened here yet either.
You might have a problem selling your book here, though, Mr. Secretary.
Oh, too controversial.
No. Not famous enough. I just think you might be a bit of a known unknown.
Well, anyway, I did want to explain that I meant nothing disrespectful in the comment I made on Fox News. It was just my way of saying I thought this crowd in the White House now screwed up what I thought was a very good relationship we had with you.
Well, all they did was try to keep my brother from being reelected.
Oh, it's not all about me. You liked me, didn't you, Rummy?
Hey, you were somebody else's account. I had my hands full with Iraq.
Yes, how'd that turn out?
I hear if they ever let O.J. Simpson out of jail, he's going to find the real WMDs.
Well, listen, fellas, no hard feelings on the train date bit.
Oh, if anybody was going to be offended by it, I think it would be the Russians. They're the ones who are getting along with us now, and they're not trained anything.
although the new Russian ambassador does speak pretty good Pashto.
No, so does the American ambassador. As long as the translator app on his iPhone is working.
Good luck on the book tour, Mr. Secretary.
Thanks. If you'd like, I'll send over an autographed copy.
That's just more to pack. We're moving out next week. But thanks for the call. We had help this week from the Afghan Presidential Transition Commission, where a new tomorrow comes by every day.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. Who knows who'll be running this network next week?
Maybe that law firm.
Maybe some cult. Maybe we'll just go into reruns, like the country. But anyway, listen again soon for another edition of Cars I Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the statement by Dick Cheney on Fox News was not the only surfacing reported this week by a former high Bush administration official. No, Dick Cheney came out again. I don't mean came out. I mean he emerged. He says if he had to make the same decisions and actions regarding the waterboarding of prisoners, he would. He was speaking to students at American University in Washington, D.C., when he said he had no regrets about the U.S. use of enhanced interrogation techniques. Reporters are still using that phrase, such as waterboarding on terrorism suspects. Quote, if I had to do it all over again, I would, Cheney said. The results speak for themselves, unquote. Many consider the use of waterboarding to be torture, says this report from the UPI service. Yeah, like the United States when Japan did it during World War II, many. Cheney disagrees. Some people called it torture. It wasn't torture. It's Cheney's explanation. What was it? Oh, that's right. It was fun.
Well, it may not be legal, but it sure as heck makes me safer. And it may not yield useful intel. At least that's what they say. It's a
Scoop. It's not torture if I say it ain't. Those conventions are so old and quaint. Terrorists are gonna have some fun.
Keep America number one.
So let's do what we say we never ever do. No way. Let's go.
Like surfing, 'cause you can't get off if you want to. And it's really hard work, but for us it feels much more like play. If the tables were turned, we'd feel really burned. But let's go water.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Monica Allen is a brain cancer survivor who co-founded Glam Runner, an organization that sells racing tutus to raise money for a youth development program. But Self Magazine took a picture of her and ran a snarky caption saying it was lame to race in a tutu. Now Self-Editor-in-Chief Lucy Danziger has apologized. "I am personally mortified," Danziger says. "I had no idea Monica had been through cancer. It was an error. It was a stupid mistake. We shouldn't have run the item." Unquote. She's probably just ticked off that she didn't trademark the word selfie when she could. Ebony Magazine apologized to the Republican National Committee after an editor dismissively referred to a black RNC staffer as white and equated conservatives to, quote, "a house full of roaches." A London man Thursday spotted a British Airways promotion in London's tube system that encourages strap hangers to, quote, "escape the commute and discover the Indian Ocean." The airline tweeted an apology, writing the advert contained pre-scheduled content that we recognize is inappropriate at this time. Deadline Paris, France apologized to Morocco this week after the kingdom's foreign minister was searched while transiting at a Paris airport. Lucky he wasn't in Atlanta. This is the latest incident that has strained the ties between Rabat and its former colonial ruler. The two countries are already at odds over a row that erupted in February when French police tried to question the head of Rabat's intelligence service during a visit to Paris over accusations his agency was involved in torture. This is why you'll never see Dick Cheney in Paris. Dateline Tripoli, Libya. Libyan state TV has aired footage showing one of late dictator Muammar Gaddafi's sons jailed in Libya, apologizing to that nation and asking for forgiveness. Police authorities say the video is in response to rumors that Gaddafi is being tortured in custody. Dick Cheney says it isn't torture. And former NSA chief Michael Hayden says in Der Spiegel that he's prepared to apologize to Angela Merkel for the revelations that she had been wiretapped listened in on by the NSA. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And it'd be just like waiting a while to discover the Indian Ocean if you would agree to join with me then. Well, you already, thank you very much, Typical show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson at WWNO. And thanks to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, yours for the clicking at harryshearer.com. And the Car's Eye guys are on Cars I Talk t-shirts. They're also available at harryshearer.com. Get them before they turn out dated. And I'm yakking to you on Twitter, yakking graphically, at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO, New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.